Chapter 15. Teddy Hillsgrove. Teddy Hillsgrove focused his entire attention to the viewfinder. It had been preset with painstaking precision by Joshua McLaren, and Teddy was terrified that he might jog the dial or knock over the tripod or do some other clumsy thing and bring Mr. McLaren's wrath down on his head. He had always been aware of the enmity between his father Bill and his friend Danny's uncle, and he was quite frankly terrified of Joshua McLaren. He wiped beads of anxious perspiration from his head and glanced around. The crowd was closing in on him, and Mrs. Murray's wretched-looking son was positively breathing down his neck. He looked into the viewfinder again. He saw two barrel images bobbing along on two streams of water. He knew what he had to do. When the two images came together, he was to raise the red flag, and his father would release the barrel. At least he hoped his father would release the barrel. He could see two images of his father and brothers on board the boat. His brothers were out there because of their superior muscles, but Teddy knew perfectly well that he had the superior brain, and that's why he was on shore, and why he had the major responsibility. Mr. McLaren had been extraordinarily patient with the Hillsgrove family. Not less terrifying than usual, but obviously holding back his impatience as he explained in words of one syllable exactly what they were supposed to do. Bill Hillsgrove had mostly been looking the other way and making lewd jokes about Mrs. Murray and her bathing suit. There were times when Teddy wished he had a different father. The responsibility rested heavily on his shoulders. Timing was critical. Let her go too soon, and Mrs. Murray would be launched into the wrong current. Leave it too long, and almost the entire Hillsgrove family would go over the falls with her. Teddy wasn't especially fond of his muscle-bound brothers, but he wasn't ready to lose them to the waterfall. The images were closing. Teddy concentrated. He wondered what it was like for her, locked up in that stuffy barrel. She had to be going crazy in there. He fingered the red flag just to make sure that it was ready. There was a great roar from the crowd. Teddy looked up and looked around and then looked out at the boat. He saw his father lean over the stern and take hold of the tow rope. He checked the rangefinder. It was too soon. What were they doing? He hadn't waved the flag. Frank Murray pulled frantically on his arm. "What's happening?" he asked. Teddy shook his head. "I don't know." "Damn!" Frank looked around at the crowd. "Look at that!" he shouted. "Why didn't someone think of that?" "What?" asked Teddy. He was still looking at the barrel. His father had released the barrel. "Look at the crowd," said Frank. "Look at what they're waving." Teddy tore his eyes away from his father's boat and looked where Frank was pointing. The problem was immediately obvious. People in the crowd were happily waving all kinds of objects, and many of them could be mistaken for a red flag. Teddy's father, a man who was easily confused at the best of times, had taken one look at the crowd, decided that he had no idea what was going on, and had taken the easy way out. He had chosen to protect his own skin by releasing the barrel sooner rather than later. Teddy folded the legs of the tripod. He couldn't really blame his father. Mrs. Murray was nothing to any of them. Well, for better or worse, she was on her way. There was nothing anyone could do about it now. Joshua was pushing the boat out into the water alone when Danny finally arrived, red-faced and panting, having raced down the cliff path at top speed. "Where the hell have you been?" Joshua grunted. "The damn gate was locked," Danny said. "I had to find Renfrew to open it for me. Do you want me to help you with that?"
Joshua looked at his nephew's excited face.
Well, Danny had probably guessed already, all those jokes about spectacles. Joshua knew that maintaining his own pride was not the important thing. Not today. "Hold on a minute," he said. "I want you to read something for me."
"What?"
"Read it, please." He held out the water-soaked note that he had been keeping in his pocket. "Come on, lad."
"What's the matter?" Danny asked. "Have you forgotten your spectacles?"
"I've no time for joking. Not today," Joshua said. "I can't read. You know that, don't you?"
"I sort of guessed it," Danny admitted, "although I don't understand why you can't."
"Neither do I," Joshua said, "but I can't. So read it to me, please." He offered the paper again, but Danny ignored him, listening instead to the shouts from the clifftop.
"They've released her," Danny said, awestruck. "This is it, Uncle."
"What?"
Joshua stuffed the note back into his pocket. "Get into the boat, boy. She could be over any minute." Joshua leaped in behind Danny and cranked the engine. The motor roared into life, and they sped out from the shore. He concentrated on steering a path between the rocks and the eddies, heading out to try to find the slack water at the edge of the cataract. All the time, he kept one eye on the cascading waterfall, waiting for the black dot to come hurtling downward. There was nothing, nothing at all. Only seagulls calling to each other. He throttled back on the motor and held the boat steady, just out of reach of the hungry foam. The crowds up above babbled and shouted. He strained his ears, trying to listen to what was being said. They were trying to tell him something. "I think they're saying she's stuck," said Danny. Joshua's heart sank. He cut the engine back still further and listened carefully. Yes, that's what they were saying. She was hung up.
"She's hung up," Danny said.
"Aye," said Joshua. He'd never mentioned it to her. He'd warned her of everything else, but he never warned her that she might be hung up on the rim. Of course, he'd known it was possible, but he'd been so sure that he'd chosen the correct launch point. The water was deep, the current was strong. She should never have been carried into the rocks. Never. How close was she to the rim, he wondered. That was the question.
"What do we do now?" Danny asked.
"God only knows," said Joshua.
"Shouldn't we go up there and see?" Danny asked. He was eager and didn't know enough yet to be afraid.
I'm not sure," said Joshua. "She could break free any minute. It depends what she's hung up on."
"But we can get her back, can't we?" Danny asked.
Joshua turned on him.
"Don't ask so many damn fool questions," he said. "I don't know what we can do."
The bow of the boat bucked, and Joshua realized they had come too close to the falls. He kicked the gear into reverse. He'd been losing concentration, and they were almost under the waterfall themselves. He'd do her no good by drowning himself. He knew she had oxygen for maybe 3 hours, if she breathed carefully and didn't panic. Should he wait below and hope the barrel would move? Or should he beach the boat and go up and see the lay of the land? If she was far enough back from the rim, perhaps he could go out in Hillsgrove's boat and retrieve her. No, that was hoping too much.
"Think," he said to himself. "Don't panic. Think."
"She can't stay there forever," Danny said desperately. Joshua shook his head. "Of course she can't. Eventually, the barrel will break up. She'll come over one way or another, alive or dead."
"And we just wait?" Danny asked.
"No, we don't," said Joshua, making up his mind. "You wait, but I'm going up there. She could still come over, lad, so if she does, it'll be up to you."
"Me?"
Danny's voice was a squeak. Joshua took hold of his nephew's shoulder. "You can do it," he said. "Now, take me ashore." Evangeline. The motion of the barrel changed, and Evangeline guessed that she had been released from the boat and was now in the current. For a few moments, the motion was quite pleasant. The barrel remained upright and seemed just to be gently moving. Then, suddenly, the barrel started to whirl round and round and round. The mouthful of coffee that she'd choked down earlier began to churn in her stomach. Her breathing quickened into panicky little gasps. Someone was screaming. Someone in the barrel with her was crying out, oh, God, stop it, stop it!" But there was no one in the barrel with her. She was doing it herself and wasting her precious oxygen. She forced herself to be calm. She couldn't think clearly in the bouncing, spinning barrel, but she tried to concentrate on keeping the coffee from coming up again. "Swallow," she told herself. "That's it. Force it down. Don't tense up. Relax. Relax. It won't be for long. It can't go on much longer. Soon there'll be the fall, and then it will be over." With a jarring shock, the barrel stopped spinning. She felt it topple onto its side, and she was face down, with only her forearms preventing her from suffocating in the padding. This must be it. She was going to fall. "Please, God," she prayed, "don't let me go head first." But there was no falling. There was no more movement. The barrel was entirely still. She opened her eyes. There was no glimmer of light. She was breathing cold, stale air, trapped in the cradle of her arms, and she wasn't moving. Could this be the end? Was she already dead? Was this hell? To be confined forever in this dark space, cut off from all human contact? Was it for this that she had risked everything? Joshua.
The crowd on shore jeered at Bill Hillsgrove. They knew something had gone wrong, and the only person to blame was the captain of the launch boat.
Joshua heard the shouting as he came storming up from the river.
And he added to it by calling Hillsgrove a sniveling coward, and a lot of other names he would not generally use in a public place. Bill had pulled his boat ashore and stood with arms folded, glaring at Joshua.
"I didn't have no choice," he protested. "Don't you go calling me names. I'd like to have seen you do better."
"Does anyone have binoculars?" Joshua asked.
"You should have seen it, Josh," Bill whined.
"Red bloody flags everywhere.
You never thought of that, did you? You never thought that someone else might be waving something red?"
"No, I didn't," Joshua admitted. "There were a lot of things I didn't think of, and this is one of them."
He concentrated on focusing the binoculars. He could see the barrel quite clearly, just a few yards from the brink, wedged on its side between two rocks with water racing by. He wondered what she was feeling. It would be as cold as a tomb in there, trapped in the freezing water. He wondered if she was conscious or if she'd already passed out from lack of oxygen.
The crowd fell silent, watching him, and he knew they were waiting to hear what he would say next. Cornelia Braithwaite had descended from her viewing platform, leaving behind her marchers and her brass band,
and she buzzed at his elbow with impatient questions.
Her face was pale, and the hand that clasped his arm was none too steady.
"What happens next?" she asked.
He lowered the binoculars and looked her straight in the eye. "She suffocates," he said.
"No," Cornelia shook her head. "You can't let that happen."
"That's a nothing. That's neither victory nor a glorious death. That's nothing but ignominy.
Surely the barrel will break free eventually."
"Aye," said Joshua. "Eventually. It'll break free or break up."
"So surely you should be down there waiting for her."
Joshua shook his head. "You need me up here," he said.
"What can you do?" Frank Murray wailed. "What can anyone do?"
Joshua felt momentarily sorry for the boy.
"We'll do something, lad," he said.
He gripped Bill Hillsgrove's arm. "Bill," he said, "I'm going to give you another chance to be a hero."
"If you think I'm going out there," Bill said, "you can think again. I remember the last time."
"So do I," said Joshua.
"I'm not doing it," Bill repeated.
"No, Jumbo," said Joshua. "I wouldn't expect you to. Go down below to my boat and give Danny a hand. He's on his own down there."
"Oh, yeah, sure." Bill sounded heartily relieved. "I'll do that. Yeah, I'll do that. Are you coming?"
Joshua shook his head.
"I'm staying up here. I'm going to set her loose. Go on, get down there. She still might break free on her own, and it'll take two pairs of hands to pull her in." "Go on, man."
Bill didn't have to be told again. Joshua watched the man retreating back. Down below, Bill Hillsgrove might still redeem himself, but Joshua didn't want him involved in what was about to happen up here at the falls. Joshua raised the binoculars again and surveyed the rusted remains of the barge.
Well, if the barrel had to be hung up anywhere, this was the best of a bad lot.
She was caught on the same rocky ledge that had trapped the barge, but she was much closer to the Canadian shore. A line strung from the roof of the powerhouse to the barge would pass right over the barrel. It had been 5 years since he'd stood on the deck of that barge, and it had been a dark night and no time to take stock of his surroundings. He tried to remember if there had been anything that might still remain and still be sturdy. A railing, a stanchion, or a deck fitting that would be an anchor for a grappling hook. There would have to be something. It was her only hope. The equipment was still at the powerhouse.
Joshua knew it hadn't been used since the barge ran aground, but he also knew the pessimistic storekeeper had kept it, just in case.
He looked around at the rapidly swelling crowd and recognized friends, neighbors, and comrades-in-arms pushing their way to the front. They freely offered their suggestions, their help, the use of their muscles, but no one offered to go in his place. It wasn't going to be easy this time. Not that it had been easy the last time. But at least there had been men on board the barge to catch the line and pull it in, dragging the heavier cable with it. This time they could only attach a cable to a grappling hook and fire it across the void in the hope that it would catch on something, catch firmly enough to hold the weight of a man. Time raced by. Time they could ill afford. Joshua imagined Evangeline using up her scant resources of air and fretted as he watched the workers launching rocket after rocket, overshooting the barge again and again. A couple of times they thought the hook had caught firmly, but each time the line pulled free under pressure. Joshua was wondering if he could possibly tie a line around himself and swim out there. She seemed so close.
But he knew he stood very little chance of getting more than a couple of feet offshore before he would be swept into the current.
At last, they succeeded. The concerted effort of 10 men pulling on the line failed to budge the rope. This time it was firmly anchored to the barge. Joshua stripped off his jacket and handed it to Frank Murray, who had stood silently at his side this whole time. "How are you going to bring her back?" Frank asked. Nell took Frank's arm and looked him in the eye. "He's not bringing her back," she said. "He can't."
"What do you mean?" Frank blurted out. "I thought he was going to rescue her."
"Of course he's going to rescue her," Cornelia interrupted, pushing Frank aside with an impatient hand.
"Why else would he be going? Get on with it, man, for goodness sakes."
The last remark was addressed to Joshua in tones of bitter impatience and panic. "I'm not rescuing her," Joshua said. "Not in the way you think. No one can rescue her. I'm simply giving her another chance. There's no way in hell I can get her out of that barrel. I'm going to break her free and send her over the brink."
"No," Cornelia gasped. "Don't do that."
"Why not?" Joshua said. "That's what you wanted, wasn't it? You wanted her to go over."
"Not anymore," Cornelia said. "I've changed my mind."
"It's too late to change your mind," Joshua replied. Nell touched Joshua's arm gently. "Be careful, Josh," she said. "Aren't I always?" Joshua asked. "No," Nell said, "you are not." Frank Murray extended a hand and Joshua shook it firmly. "I'll do my best for your mother," he said.
"Are you sure I can't do anything?" the boy asked. "I feel as though it's all my fault."
Joshua patted the boy's shoulder. "It's not your fault, lad. I don't think anyone could make your mother do something she didn't want to do." He looked out at the thin cable running down from the powerhouse roof and across to the barge. So frail and so far. There had been a time in his youth when he'd seen the great Blondin walk such a cable. The Frenchman walked the rope backwards and forwards, stood on his head, turned somersaults, and even carried someone on his back. Those were the days. But what would Blondin do now? Backflips and somersaults would not move the barrel. The only thing that was going to move it was sheer brute force. Joshua climbed into the sling of the breeches buoy and allowed the ring to settle around his waist. He took a firm hold of the pulley ropes and swung himself out and away from the roof. "Let her go," he called, and suddenly he was flying downwards and outwards, racing toward the river. The cable dipped with his weight, and he was only inches above the smoothly sliding water. Soon he was soaked in spray, and his borrowed gloves were worn through from his death grip on the harness as it swayed back and forth. His hands were already raw and bloody. His precipitous descent slowed. The men on the roof were holding back on the lines. He checked his progress, looking down and around. He caught his breath and fought down his panic. He could see clearly what was in front of him and below him. Years ago, crossing by torchlight had seemed the stuff of nightmares, but it was nothing in comparison to crossing in daylight and seeing for himself the distant shore, the rocks, the water sliding smoothly over the brink of the falls, and the frailty of the cable that held him. He inched forward. He was above the barrel. At last he could see what had happened. It was trapped against a rock and held there by the pressure of the water. Surely a good kick would free it. He stared down at the barrel and the water rushing by. How long had she been in there? Was she still breathing? He hung down from the cable and called her name.
"Evangeline!"
"Evangeline." Evangeline saw the thunder god. She saw his face, his black braided hair, and his red-toned skin. He was wearing a leather breechcloth, and his naked chest and arms were painted in magnificent writhing patterns of yellows and mauves, blue and pink, all the colors of the rainbow. He held a white fur robe in his arms, and he was standing at the entrance to an ice cave. He beckoned her to come. Deep inside the cave, she saw a glowing orange light. The cave seemed warm and inviting. Shadowy figures danced and leaped in the flickering light. Firelight from a fire that burned without melting the ice. Warmth that existed alongside the intense cold. A maiden came from the cave. She wore a beaded doeskin dress and an embroidered headband.
She took the fur robe from the Thunder God and held it out, inviting Evangeline to wrap herself in its warmth.
"Come with us," she said.
"Who are you?"
"Lila Walla, the Maid of the Mist. Come beneath the rainbow. Come beneath the water. Come with the rest of us." Evangeline took a step forward. The shadowy, dancing figures were clearer now and recognizable. The boy, Richard Steinhaus, his missing limbs miraculously restored, and so many others, sailors and soldiers in antique uniforms, men and women in the clothes of another century.
"Where's John?" she asked. "Where's my husband?"
"He didn't die here," Lila Walla said. "This is only for those who die beneath the rainbow. Come, we've been waiting for you. Come to the fire. Come and be warmed."
"I'm so cold," Evangeline said.
"Then come."
"Yes," she said. And then a great voice from somewhere outside the cave shouted her name. "Evangeline!"
"Joshua."
Joshua listened, but heard no answering call from Evangeline. No evidence that she had heard his voice. Out here the air was quiet. There was an atmosphere of peace. He felt an overwhelming desire to release his harness and drop into the water. Just let go and let it happen. Not yet. He stretched down with his right leg. He could touch the barrel with the toe of his boot, but the water pressure held it against the rocks. He would have to push sideways. Just a couple of inches was all it would need, and the current would do the rest. She'd be over and gone in a few seconds. He took a deep breath and levered himself upwards and out over the harness. With his legs freed, he gripped the ring of the round buoy and swung down until he was well below the buoy, holding on to nothing but the canvas sling. Then he let his body drop so that he could reach the barrel with both feet. He drew his knees up and then kicked, hard, downwards. Nothing. He kicked again. No movement. Hanging painfully at the full extension of his arms, he inserted a booted foot between the barrel and the rock and twisted his leg. The pain was excruciating as the barrel ground against his ankle. But he was winning. The barrel was moving. He twisted still more and the barrel began to slide, grinding his ankle fiercely into the rock.
He was dizzy with pain, but the barrel was on its way. Smoothly, silently, it slid around the side of the rock. It spun around once, and then it was gone. Over and downward.